Hello, everybody. Welcome to Angie's Own Creation podcast. I'm your host, Christian Mastrodonato. In this podcast, I bring together my knowledge in complex systems with my experience in leading technology innovation and new product development to explore how successful products, organizations, and ideas emerge. This is a special episode, since it is Angie's Own Creation birthday. 1 year ago, we started this interesting journey, and I have to thank all of you for listening and supporting this project. Please don't forget to like, follow, and share our episodes to help this podcast grow. As you know, innovation is our current topic of this podcast. And to celebrate the birthday properly, I decided to invite a real chief innovation officer. So today, we delve into the innovative mind of Carsten Lambay, a seasoned pioneer in the realm of new business development and creation. Carsten kicks off the interview with an introduction to his intriguing career trajectory, highlighting his early adoption of groundbreaking technologies such as personal computers, 3D printing, and blockchain. His journey from consulting on PCs at the Danish Technology Institute to exploring the potential of water management as a critical resource showcases his ability to stay ahead of the curve. With Carsten, we then address the unique challenges of fostering innovation within a utility company, a sector traditionally perceived as conservative due to the high stakes associated with water safety and quality. He shares his company's ambitious goal to slash the time from concept to market impact from the industry average of 20 years down to just 5. This is achieved through a culture that encourages all employees to contribute ideas and a methodology that embraces co-creation with partners and suppliers. The conversation then shifts to a concept of controlled chaos in innovation, where Carsten draws on the concept of walking in wilderness. He advocates for an environment of psychological safety and balance between maintaining cooperation and allowing the periphery of the organization to experiment and innovate. This approach ensures that new ideas can be safely tested and gradually integrated into the main business, fostering a dynamic yet stable environment for change. Carsten also shares his insights on leading innovation, emphasizing the importance of vision, enthusiasm, and the ability to adapt direction as necessary. He stresses the significance of assembling a team smarter than oneself, granting them autonomy, and resisting the urge to micromanage. This leadership style not only accelerates the innovation process, but also captures unforeseen opportunities that arise along the way. Lastly, the interview touches on the broader implication of innovation for organizational change. Carsten introduces the concept of TEAL organization, and he discusses the need for agility in decision-making and the decentralization of authority to empower teams. By doing so, companies can become more responsive and evolve more effectively, ultimately leading to a culture that embraces complexity and thrives on continuous improvement. This interview touches so many relevant topics related to innovation, and I'm really excited to share those with you. So, let's go! Welcome, Carsten, to Angels of Creation podcast, and thanks a lot for making the time for us. I'm very excited about today's interview, and I'm sure we're going to sort of explore a lot of interesting aspects of innovation. But I think the best way, of course, for the listeners to know more about you is to hear from you a bit of introduction about what you do and what you did in the past. So floor to you, Carsten, and let us know more about yourself.
Thanks a lot, Christian, and thanks for having me. It's always exhilarating to share what you're passionate about. My name is Carsten Lambay. I am head of business development, business creation, we call it, at the Danish utility, which is a bit odd that a utility has business development and business creation, but yes, we are a bit odd. We do make new companies, actually, and we make new services and new products. My career has always been looking into new possibilities, new opportunities coming mainly from tech. Technology gives us new ways of doing things. Looking back, it's been I have a tendency to be a bit early on new developments. In 88, I was a consultant in personal computers and CAD CAM CNC programming, at the Danish Technological Institute, which and PCs at that time was a bit, it was sort of a novelty, especially in large companies. So Lego, the toy manufacturer developer, hired me as a consultant on using PCs for CNC machining. And in one of the meetings at Lego, an engineer came into the room with a, you know, a very tiny slip of paper he had torn out of a magazine, saying, "You know, guys, in America, they'd invented a machine that can print stuff." And we were all like, "Yeah, nah, that can't be real." But curiosity caught us, and we had to figure out if this was true. And the year after, I took some Danish companies, Grundfos, Lego, Danfoss, on a tour to the US to see this amazing machine that could print stuff. And a year later, we had the first machine back in Denmark as the first publicly available machine in Scandinavia. After 3D printing, which really took off like 6 years later, it was using computers, workstations at that time for simulating product design, product development, and simulation. Then came virtual reality, which really haven't caught on yet. I guess what we see in augmented reality is now catching on, maybe. I still need to see a proof of that. And then in 2016, I was sent to Silicon Valley again to investigate new stuff. And at that time, I brought back the notion of blockchains and the abilities of that technology. And it has caught on, but not, you know, in the way it can catch on. So I think blockchain was also a bit early there. And then now it's water. I'm focusing on water. Water has caught on. Everybody needs water, and it's getting increasingly important how we treat water, how we value water, and how we preserve and conserve water. So that's my focus now, and that's the domain we work in. And actually, the funny thing is that going back to Silicon Valley, which is, I think, a fascinating place to visit and learn stuff, on water, on the water issue, I wouldn't say it's completely opposite that Silicon Valley needs our input, but they are certainly interested in what Denmark and Europe does on water, because we have a lot to share in that direction. So that's sort of my career in short. I'm an old man, so it could be much longer. But
well, if this is the short version, yes, I wonder what would be the long version. But that's very interesting and helpful. And this breadth of experience across innovation is definitely what we are looking for here in the podcast. So it's very interesting, also the transformation in a way, because as you mentioned, you started talking, of course, a lot about technology and focusing on technology innovation. But now you work in a commodity space, in a utility, which, I mean, as you pointed out, especially from the perspective of sustainability, is one of the areas that needs more innovation worldwide. And that's a fair point. But it also plays that historically tends to be less innovative, just because dealing basically, as you said, with water, which is something that you kind of take for granted, and probably you expect this sort of technology has been sort of created and invented centuries ago, or millennia if you go back to the Roman Empire and things like that. So I'm kind of thinking, how do you approach innovation as an innovation leader in a space like this one? Because I think that's actually where most of the people find usually themselves. Of course, it's nice and easy to be in a Silicon Valley startup.
But most of the people out there, they're working on a, let me call, a real business doing real stuff every day, maybe with legacy processes and a legacy culture. And so how do you do innovation in a space like that? And you alluded that actually your utility, the company you're working on, is kind of odd in that sense. And it might set a nice example.
It's true. And I often meet people, and I've been in companies like that myself, you know, large corporations, and they complain about speed and agility, then try utility. That's something else. I understand, I get it. If you work in General Motors or real large corporations, things have inertia, and it takes time to make a decision. It takes time to take new tracks for the company. In the water domain, I've found meta studies looking at the speed of innovation, and in average it takes 20 years from concept to market impact. So that is really long incubation of new innovation. If you are one of the fast movers, you can do this in 10 years from concept to market impact. We are aiming at reducing this to 5 years. And it's not just because that water is a, you know, a common commodity that everybody takes for granted. It's also a conservative business, because if you screw up, you kill people. You pollute, you may serve the citizens polluted water, and they die or get sick and so on. So we are very cautious and very careful not to experiment with the quality or the safety of the water. So that makes sense. But at the same time, we need to be a lot more agile, because technology moves way faster than 20 years from concept to impact. And we need to keep sort of up to speed on the new developments and the new possibilities we get. In Denmark, water utilities are regulated to be 2% more efficient on investments and on operations every year. And we've been regulated like this for 15 years. So the low-hanging fruit have been picked. Now we're looking at or aiming at higher hanging fruits, and you can't do that just by running faster or working smarter. You need to do things in new ways. And I can't take credit for this, but the company I joined, Aarhusvand, almost 7 years ago, they were already in this transition. They've been privatized. Oh, that's now, I guess, 12 years ago or something like that, 15 maybe. And in this transition from being a publicly run by the municipality, we're now a private company, although 100% owned by the municipality, but we have our own board and so on. Innovation has been put very high on the agenda to keep up with new regulation and the regulation of efficiency. And the methodology in this has been letting innovation free at all levels. So if people have a problem, if they have encounter a problem or something that's slow, inefficient, could be done smarter, they can raise their hand and say, hey, this valve or this way of doing things is, I think it could be done better. Then we have a talk about it and say, well, go ahead, try, fix it. Here's a budget for testing. Don't implement it in our operations, but let's have a test on it. And through some iterations, we either discard the idea or we implement the idea. And then we celebrate. Then we give credit to the, not just the guy who raised the hand, but the team who undertook the innovation. And this is sometimes, actually rather seldom, but sometimes it's done just by ourselves. But in most cases, it's involving our partners, our suppliers, our contractors, or something related to us. So we co-create really a lot. We base our innovation power on reaching out. We can only do so much. We are a rather small company, and we have rather limited resources. But gearing our efforts, our challenges with the innovation and the competencies and the solutions of our external companies, partners, we tend to create new solutions based on our challenge, our knowledge, and their technologies. And sometimes it ends up in a new product for this company, and then we have the solution we can buy from somebody. Sometimes we put very much knowledge into a product and we get a license fee from helping the company having this new service or product. And in certain cases, now 5 cases, we create a new company based on our competencies and this, usually the technology of the partner. And this is also part of our regulation that we can do this. So it's really building culture over many years, embracing co-creation with partners and celebrating and giving credit to both partners and employees along the way. And as an innovation leader, you need to be modest. You really do not take the credit for these successes. You need to let the light shine on the people creating the solutions, not you as a leader.
That's very, very interesting. Thanks a lot. And it's a very interesting insight in a company like yours that is bringing a new model of innovation, I would say, in a space that tend to be very conservative. Before we move to the sort of the next chapter of our conversation, I have a comment and a question. So one comment is definitely that the co-creation is a key element to enable innovation. Completely agree with you. We actually had some times ago as a guest, Alexander Poniewierski from EY, that actually spent a lot of time and wrote a book exactly about that and this topic, because it was really like he considered that the core enabler, I would say, for the creation of new business model. If you want to move fast, you need to work with others, and that's very important. The other thing, you talk about celebrating success, but you also talk about iteration. And so, what about failure, though? I assume there are a lot of failures. So how do you encourage them? How do you manage them? Because I think the whole point of innovating is also take risks and fail. So how do you manage that?
Well, it's a matter of framing it, I think. We tend not to call them failures. They actually sometimes it's really a failure. But most of the time it's learning. So often, something we think will be a smashing success does not work, or it doesn't work the way we thought it should, or as good as we thought it should. But we take it more as an input to the process and of learning. A very simple case is. In many countries, you have rainwater pipes and you have sewage pipes. And in Denmark, we have the problem that the separation between the two, if they are on top of each other, which is stupid, but sometimes they are, you need to go through one pipe to get to the next pipe. And the cover in this pipe rusted, was blown away, and so on. It was a very down-to-earth problem, but a huge problem, because you then get rainwater and sewage water mixed. And through a period of, I think, 10 years, we experimented, because it was really a big problem for us. And I think we had like 8 or 10 iterations, some very complicated, some simple but inefficient, and so on. And every time we sort of celebrated that we got one step further, that, hey, great, we now can discard this solution that doesn't work, and we have this solution that we think works. And once 2 or 3 years down the line, we figured out it's not really a good solution, this one, then we have the opportunity to celebrate the next solution. And finally, after, I think, 10 years, we have this solution that is now in license. We have given a license to this cover to Per Aarsleff, which is a very huge international contractor. And it's just framing that a simple solution on a cover for a sewer can be, it can take 10 years and multiple iterations to get to the final solution. And along the way, we failed, you may call it that. Actually, we learned a lot. So all the learning is now incorporated in the final solution.
Yeah, that's a beautiful answer. Thank you. And I think that's really the point about having a problem you want to solve and being persistent on that and take learning on boards to get to the final solution.
I think I also might add that it's part of the culture. Maybe it's a Scandinavian trait, I don't know, but it's part of, I think, all the companies I've worked in, that you don't really get blamed for failure. I have encountered companies where it's really bad to fail because the boss yells at you or you get not promoted or whatever could hit you after a failure. In most cases, it's okay to fail because you have been given the mandate or the responsibility to move ahead and the understanding following the mandate that, yes, of course, you can't make 100% right decisions over the course of a development. It is iteration. Otherwise, you're not daring enough.
Yes, agreed. That closes perfectly the example you gave and the importance, yes, of the job in that case is to learn, not necessarily to succeed. Eventually, you will succeed by learning, but you're taking risks and that's the point. So taking risk means also accepting failure if that happens. And that's super important. So thank you. So I think I would move to the next step. We discussed a lot about the overall approach in your company, and again, how that approach makes it special, definitely in the context of sort of the wider utility landscape. But I'm also more interested about the specific role of an innovation leader like you in an organization like this one, but of course also in the other organization, the other things you did in the past. Okay, so what are the core ingredients to be a leader? You touched earlier about giving credit and not taking the credit for you, but actually enabling this culture where, of course, people are celebrated for the good work they do. What are the other elements that sort of are part of your job to enable innovation?
I can't claim this to be the model for an innovation leader I because there are many ways to be this, but I can tell you what I do and how I see it being done. I have a long time accepted that I'm by far the smartest person needed in developing new stuff. My role is to have the vision and to engage and to make the team enthusiastic about the endeavor that we're going into. And then keeping the light on in the direction I think we're moving, but accepting that my direction and the common direction that we agree on may not be a constant one. So I have the role of looking out for the lighthouses in the darkness that we're sailing into, and then communicating this to the team, and having them deciding with me on should we change course, are we on a path that is right for us, or the opportunities that is now present to us. at the same time, I have to be careful not to introduce too many new input on direction changes, because then we, you know, move in circles or move zigzag more than needed. But having this role of the outlook, sharing it with the team and aligning sponsorship, aligning buy-in from the organization, which is crucial, is my role. And then setting a team of way smarter people than yourself, because I don't know, you need people in tech or in business modeling or in economics, or you need to know what's needed, but you don't need to be the expert yourself. There are way smarter people out there in the organization or with your partners, and you need to have a knack of identifying them and bringing them in. And then, which is, for at least for my part, important, is to give the team some autonomy, that they decide on progress, actions, and so on. So, I guess, in short, you should really not micromanage innovation, because it kills the passion, it kills the opportunities, or it kills your ability to seize the opportunities that arise along the way. And this is what makes your innovation step up faster than if you have a really rigid plan for developing something. You don't have the ability to take in new opportunities. And new opportunities always arise, especially when you look for them, but also when you don't look for them.
I like your point about sort of giving the team some autonomy and trying not to micromanage them. But often in the past, at least my experience with innovation in good places where innovation was happening and good creative places, there is a tendency to, let me use the word, chaos. I'm going to explain in a second. It's actually something that popped up also in one of my latest interview with a completely different topic in that case. And we're talking about phase transitions, okay? And there are actually some research showing that innovation in biology, for example, happens into this phase transition, which is actually a very chaotic place, because it's you're moving from one state to another, and everything can change very quickly and very often. So there is an element of kind of, in a sense, actually creating disorder on purpose. Is it something you resonate with, or is it something in your experience to sort of enable an element of chaos?
Oh, it resonates perfectly. I think that's been part of my career. Chaos is always there, in the background or really in the front. And at Aarhus Vand, I didn't coin it or frame it in any way, but they call it walking in wilderness. And this is something you have to train. Some people are fine with it. They're born like they inhabit chaos like a fish water. But most people, after, you know, 20 minutes or one day in wilderness, they start to think, well, we should get stuff done, we should organize, we should have a plan, or we should be able to report on something. And we, all the way from our management board and down to your everyday Joe, you get asked to train a little bit or a lot your ability to walk in wilderness, because looking for solutions that you don't know you need, or looking for framing a project or a problem or challenge can take days, weeks in what you call chaos. You don't really know where you're going. You know what you're looking for, but you have absolutely no clue where to look for it. Or you know where you're going, but you don't know what you're looking for. That's the opposite, but it's sort of the same thing, that you eventually you get really annoyed of not finding anything or having any clue of what's happening. And you then, at that point, you need to be able to take just one more day. And eventually you should call it quits. But if you don't find anything, but the ability to be there as an individual and as a team is something you need to train, because it's usually the lowest denominator that stresses you. So if you're a team of five people and you have one guy who can be, or one person who can be in wilderness for 1 hour, then that's where the frustration starts. If you have a team of that can be in wilderness for days and days, then they can be there longer. But you really seldomly can set a team of homogeneous wilderness people. So it's okay to raise your hand and say, hey, I'm frustrated. We're not doing anything. We're not finding anything. We're just walking in circles. What can we do about it? And then you need to have the talk about where we are in the process. And currently, we are in the wilderness or the chaos process, part of the process. It's okay to be frustrated. It's actually a good thing, because it indicates that we are not going on a straight plan. Next week, we agreed to be out of the wilderness. So you have to be in the wilderness until Friday. Okay, it's really hard for me, but I'll do it. So you sort of set sort of a limit to the chaos, and you agree on that as a team. That's how we do it, at least, to embrace and acknowledge the chaos is there, and it's a good thing, because that's where stuff happens.
I like a lot. I've never heard, but I'm probably going to reuse your expression of work with the wilderness. I really like that. And because, yes, it's really part of the game. Also, while you were talking, a lot of things came to my mind. And I was thinking, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Wardley's metaphor of pioneers, settlers, and town planners. But that kind of explained the fact that depending by the maturity of your organization or of your specific product where you are, you also need kind of different kind of peoples, because yes, the people who are pioneers are definitely more comfortable with staying in the wilderness, as you said, and it can be trained, but it is a natural predisposition. But they might actually be very frustrated in a situation which is very stable and very, very efficiency driven. And it's the other way around. The town planners are the people that strive in efficiency and planning. And yeah, if you bring them in the wilderness, they might freak out very easily. And as you said, it's right to accept it. And there is an element of training for everybody and get out of their comfort zone, but also accepting that an organization needs to be made by these different people. And trying to create the right places for them instead of forcing them maybe in the areas that are not the best.
Back in, I think it was 2015 or something like that, I met John Hagel, a very thought leader in innovation and organizational change. And he, I think he was at PricewaterhouseCoopers or something like that. At that time, they created a center they called Center for the Edge. And there was the sort of the concept behind this is that you have these people able to be in chaos and in wilderness. You shouldn't put them at the center of a company, because they tend to activate the immune system of a large corporation. And if you have a center with, you know, high focus, agile people, crazy thinkers, and so on, it really spotlighted in a company, the rest of the company sort of starts to attack them as a virus. saying this is noise, it's defocusing our business and so on. That's the city contemplated, or the city people you talked about, they wouldn't have this in their city. And I think they have some very brilliant concepts in the Center for the Edge that put this kind of activity sort of in the perimeter. And if you have it there, it's not that dangerous. It's okay to be wild and have wilderness on the edge of your company. It's okay. We still have the control over the domain and our operations. And then you can gradually introduce new stuff into the core of the business. So I can recommend people to follow John Hagel or Center for the Edge, which does have some good insights and some good theories behind how to run innovation and introduce new stuff to a large organization.
That's very interesting. I didn't know John Hagel. I'm familiar with the concept of innovation at the edge that is sort of proposed, probably, I would say, maybe by others, inspired by Hagel. Then I'll definitely put the link to his website in the description of the podcast so that listeners can follow the link and know more. I'll do it myself, by the way, since it sounds very interesting. Now, if we can take a little bit a broader stance, okay, when we deal with innovation, in the end, we are dealing with a cultural change and also company evolution, which kind of you gave the example earlier, even with the edge example. Okay, you move people, they're trying to do something at the edge and then you bring them back. But what's happening de facto is that your organization is evolving and is changing its operating model over time. So how would you go about that? I mean, what are your experiences in your current company, for example, or in the past, about how can we embed this constant change that innovation drives, new technologies drive into an evolving organization?
Yeah, that is a big question. I worked at a company that's you would know as an innovation leader. It's a company called Velux. They make, you know, skylight windows and so on. And they have very innovative products. But I think because of the size and because of it's many years ago since I worked there, so it's based on history, not the present. There was a lot of innovation bravada, lots of tools on the intranet, how to do stuff and how to facilitate innovation and so on. But it wasn't grounded in culture. It was sort of, you know, templates and how to do stuff. And you can go there, you can download this and you should do this and this. But the culture was sort of what you would also expect of a utility, conservative. We have this product, it's very good. How can we increment it to be a little bit better? But coming with, you know, brand new ideas, game-changing concepts, you could call it disruption. It's as in Velux, as in, I guess, any large corporation, really tricky. So I think taking the step into, I guess, empowering or letting the resources of the individual humans free, you need to change the way you organize a company, the way you manage, the way you measure a company. And I haven't got the recipe for that. But I know what we have endeavored into, which is what we call, or not we, we are adopting the philosophy behind the TEAL organization so that you work in groups, small groups formed around a task, not around sort of an organization. course, we have a matrix organization that you know who's your leader, you know who you should negotiate your salary with, and so on. But what you do is in these groups, and these groups have a job, and the job is in focus. And the group is then given a mandate, a budget, some autonomy to move ahead. And for this to succeed, you need to have a really strong purpose and you for the entire company, because otherwise the groups could go, you know, like atoms in a glass of water in any direction. But you need to have all groups working on the same agenda in the same direction, with, you know, some friction and some moving around and coordination between them, and sometimes they bump into each other. And then you have to have a culture that is open, and you have these dialogues when you bump into something you thought you should do and somebody else is doing it. Instead of having a conflict, you just solve the problem and move ahead and figure out who does it then. This will set a lot of energy free, and it will make things, operations or innovation, much more agile and have much less internal friction. Because let's face it, the larger a company gets, the more internal friction it gets because of administration, because of KPIs, because of ways things are handled, decision making, and so on. And in classical organizations, all decisions sort of aggregate up into larger decisions, and finally it ends at the CEO or the board. And this makes the CEO or the top leaders immensely crucial for decision making in classical organizations. And so a minute of a CEO's company CEO's time can then be measured in millions or billions, because we can't move ahead until the CEO says yes or no, or I need some more info or something like that. And it slows a company down. And if you can break decision making down into much more agile groups and teams, and then the CEO or the management needs to set direction, set scopes, and so on, and the larger lines for which in at the direction you need to move, then you get a very agile company. And more companies are moving in this direction. I can't claim it to be a global tendency, but large corporations and small corporations are embracing the TEAL organizational way. And we're going there now, especially to become much more agile.
Thanks. It's a nice reference. I've heard the first time about the TEAL organization from you, even though I've been interested into this sort of self-organizing organizations, if we can call it like that. There are some also, I'm aware of other examples with other names, which in the end, there is an element of building fractal organizations, because that's what you want to have, kind of having different levels, self-similar levels of decision-making. And so it doesn't really matter whether you're up or down, you know how the company operates, and also that creates a level of confidence on how decisions are made. So I have a question for you about that, though. I mean, it's very interesting because you're doing it, okay? And there is a trend, but we are probably at the beginning of the trend. I mean, as far as I know, probably I know a few tens of organizations doing that. There might be a few hundreds all over the world, if I know a few tens, but it means it's still a small percentage. So what are the challenges? Because basically you are deeply changing the culture and the ways of working while you are operating. And especially if you are in a utility commodity space, in water space, as you said, if you make a mistake, people die. It is a big problem and it is a big responsibility. So what are the challenges of making this changing, as I say, kind of building the airplane while it's flying?
Actually, I found a very good video on YouTube on building the airplane while you're flying. I'll send you the link. It's funny, but it's really, they are building a plane while they're flying. I think we accepted that this is not something that you introduce over a weekend and then you go home Friday in the old way and you meet up Monday and you're a TL organization. I haven't heard of a case that has been done in this way. So we have accepted that this transition takes perhaps 2 years, maybe more. And we are not starting with the critical infrastructure teams. They operate the way they've done always. But in innovation, in some areas in customer handling, in some areas of strategy development or communication, we introduce this, we experiment, we learn, and we have some consultants assisting us, of course, and maybe not of course, but we do, that has taken other companies through this. And then we have these steps of implementing. So this spring, we'll have like six-ish groups experimenting with ways of being a group, a TL group. And then we extract knowledge from this, implement it into six new or maybe 10 new groups and learn from that. And eventually, everybody and every or department or has then become TL. But it does not mean that every single little job has to go into a work group, because some jobs are just done by one man. Something is just a coordination between two persons or five persons. Does not need to change actually the way of working for them. But it is a transition, and we couldn't have endeavored into this 6 years ago. We weren't mature. We needed to take some initial steps to break down some organizational barriers or some cultures that were too rigid, that would have been, you know, too shocked or gone into backlog having been introduced to TL. So there has, for at least for our sake, we had some maturing to do before going in this direction. I think the time is right for Sven, my company. Is it difficult? Yes. Is it currently walking in wilderness? Yes. It is stressing some people more than others. But because we have been, you know, framing walking in wilderness years back, we know of the concept of being frustrated about wilderness. And now we can put this new transition into a wording of, well, this is where we are now. We are currently in wilderness with TL, and not having a rigid structure around how governance is done or how sponsoring is done is okay. But we'll have it by May this summer. Okay, I can live with that. And I'm not responsible for finding out the structure. Nope. Somebody else is doing it. This, that, we can point at the five people over there. Okay, phew. Well, they get back to me when they know what and tell me what to do in May. I'm fine with that. So you can take we call it psychological safety, that some people, well, we all need some sort of psychological safety in our work. And if everything is uncertain, everything is up in the air, you're really uncertain. There's no psychological safety in meeting every Monday morning. So you need to address this psychological aspect in the transition. And we do this often. It's not just something you do in January, and then I hope people remember that in April. We need to address the psychological aspects. It's okay to be frustrated. somebody's working on it. You just keep on what you're doing, and then we'll tell you what to do in May.
It needs a lot of trust, so which is, I mean, it is a very important element. You alluded earlier, there might be a Scandinavian inclination to create organizations based on trust, and so that enable that. But on the other hand, it needs also a certain level of maturity for the organization to create the level of trust to say, okay, I'm going to go with that. And then you'll tell me, May, I was going to work out. And it's, as you said, it's psychological safety, it's trust. It's very interesting because, yes, it's a deep cultural change also from the point of view of behaviors of people and interaction of people. That's very, very fascinating. Thank you very much. I think we can go to the last question, which is a common question I ask all the guests of this podcast. So what are for you the characteristics of a leader who embraces complexity?
I think some level of naivety is a good thing. I think a level of trust in your fellow team members, in your leaders is a good thing. I hope you can, as an innovation leader, feel some level of commitment and trust from your management. John Cale once framed that an innovation leader is an innovation activist, is a person accepting or willing to get fired every day. Tend to disagree. I agree that these kinds of people, that no matter the consequence, no matter the risk, I need to go in this direction. I need to try to figure out how I can make this car fly or make anti-gravity or something, you know, radical. But if you are blind of the game that you're playing in, especially large organizations, you get hit with reality too hard. So establishing, being some sort of a politician that can establish buy-in from your management or given a mandate from your management is crucial, I think. And because you address the complexity aspect, you need to be able to trust the team that's working with you or for you to figure out how to navigate in complexity. Because you for sure can only point out the lighthouses out there. They are sailing their ship, their boat, in the directions that you with them point out. So again, back to don't micromanage, because then you think you know everything, and you sure don't.
I love the don't micromanage. I think it's very important slogan that should be widely broadcasted across all the organizations. So micromanagement tends to stifle innovation, and an innovation leader knows that. So thanks a lot for this incredible conversation. Really enjoyed it. And you gave us a lot of food for thoughts on how to be better at innovation and business creation in our everyday activities, and also I know we can inspire organizations to change and become more innovative. So yeah, thank you very much, Carsten. It was great to have you here.
Thank you, Christian. It's been really a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Engines of Creation. I hope you enjoyed, like I did, the great breadth of practical knowledge about implementing innovation with Carsten Lambay. From working in wilderness to the transformation into teal organizations, we covered a lot of ground. If you want to learn more, be sure to follow Engines of Creation and leave us a rating and a review. And don't hesitate to share this episode on social media and with friends and colleagues who might be interested. This podcast counts on you to grow and help other people to understand and embrace complexity to innovate and create. If you have any questions, comments or feedback, feel free to reach out to engines of creation@masterdonato.co. I'll be glad to continue the conversation. Engines of Creation will be back soon with a new episode about healthcare innovation, and stay tuned for some new ways to engage with this podcast.